Just a little bit more. When the associated faculty came along, did you think of them as related to your earlier faculty at all?
When did they come?
Oh, I think in the 60s, late 60s.
I was not affiliated with them, and no. I just didn't know of them, actually.
So it wasn't that you said, we're getting a union started again?
No.
Interesting.
I was then probably chairman of economics, then I was on leave for a year. I don't remember it starting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, mind you, I would, if I were here, I joined the AAUP. AAUP was a partial substitute for a union. I belonged to the Associated Faculty of the University of California as well as the AAUP, so that I've been interested in university organizations, faculty organizations, and from the standpoint of again, mainly the bread and butter issues. And I would guess, not knowing about this association, that it did some of the same things.
I don't suppose any of those teaching assistants that were members then are still around, because it would be interesting to me to know whether they attempted to keep any kind of organization going before, the TAA didn't start until the mid-60s.
None of them. See, those issues came up just about the time I left.
Yeah.
I was on leave in 65, 66. I came back for 1 year, and I was doing research a good part of that time. And I planned to go back to the University of California by the very early spring of 66, 67. And so I was not much involved.
But I just wondered if the TAs during the 50s kept any kind of organization going.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. And
right.
I don't know from whom you'd get such information. Again, people who are in the School for Workers, Bob Ozan, might be able to tell you. And Ed Young might, and possibly even Jack Barbash. Those people would be the ones. Gary Summers is dead. Jim Stern might, although I've forgotten when Jim came. But I just don't know. And of course, I went out to California as chairman of the department, and I knew what was happening at UW mainly through my friendship with Ed Young and others who were by that time in administrative positions. And I gather from what I hear from departmental colleagues that there were some real problems later with the assistants. And maybe there still are.
Well, I think that's all I know.
Yeah, that pretty much takes the union up to just about
as far as
we'd want to take it.
Actually, there was a little bit of a TA beginning of a union in 1929. Not a union, but the association.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We had just, you'd started talking when the tape wasn't rolling about President Fred and his being conscious of the faculty, very conscious of the faculty. Could you expand on that just a...
Well, as I intimated, I think that Fred played a very careful kind of leadership role. As an administrator, he was a very... He protected his flanks carefully. And the faculty at UW has always been active and powerful, as university faculties go. And so he was very careful not to to cross them. And that's was part of his general style, I think.
I've heard it said that Ingram, in fact, was the one who had the more control in the faculty meetings
I would
than
think
Fred.
So. Yes, I would think so. Yeah, he is more powerful in faculty meetings. Fred, of course, was no, he just was hapless kind of in parliamentary matters and things like that. Now you want me to go back to some earlier?
Yeah, yeah. I just, if you don't mind,
yes,
I would like to just get your perceptions on, give off some names and tell me how you perceive these people, and if you feel you could speak for graduate students or shared perceptions, general perceptions around campus, please state that. Let's start with President Glenn Frank.
Yeah. Well, he was president when I first came, but as I remember, he was succeeded by Dijkstra. Well, Ingram took over for a while, did he not?
No, Sellery took over for a while.
I'm sorry, Sellery took over as acting. I was not in for much of his, Glenn Frank's tenure. My impression is that for a substantial part of the faculty felt he was a pseudo-liberal, that he was politically motivated. There was a good deal of opposition to the kind of high fashion life that he and Mary Frank had. There were jokes plenty about them giving high heel slippers and a top hat to some collection during the fresh.
You don't remember any of those jokes, do you?
Well, one was that was reported that Mary Frank had been asked to give some clothing for this, I've forgotten whether for general charity or for the younger faculty or whatever. But the story was that included in this was a pair of dancing slippers and an old high hat. And as you know, Frank wore spats, very sartorial, sort of thing. Splendid. I remember, if you don't mind this kind of incident, but again, I'd want to be sure to see it. Sadie Perlman didn't like him, nor did Sellery.
That's Sellery, pretty evident in his...
Put it mildly.
Yes, his recollection.
And perhaps you've heard that when Frank's book Thunder and Dawn appeared, and at the university club, somebody asked Sellery about had he read the book. He said, "Yes, I look through it." So what do you think of it? He said, "Well, I can hear the thunder, but I can't see the dawn." And then Sadie Truman's wife, Fanny, told us about being invited out to the Franks for dinner or something, and they came somewhat early, and so there was some sort of embarrassment, and Mary Frank could talk to them, and Penny Perlman reported that Mary Frank said, "Isn't it nice that Glenn isn't anti-Semitic?" And Fanny said, "Yes." And I said, "Yes, isn't it nice, Mrs. Frank, that Sally is not anti-Protestant?" I remember waiting on table when I was on this staff at the union, Fred met with the regents a couple of times, and Frank. Whenever I say
we should have taken this.
I don't know. I got the feeling that he was a bit of a poor flesher. And I think that was a feeling that was fairly general among the younger people, and probably through a lot of the faculty. And of course, he had the opposition of Horace Wilkie's father, who was then leader of the legislature, and the Regents, I guess, right? And the story is told that at those hearings, which I didn't hear, Frank cited the fact that in his contract there was a certain amount of money involved, and he didn't see what they had a right to reduce that. And what Mr. Wilkie said, yes, but I think the contract does not say that the regents of the university are obligated to pay Mr. Frank so many thousand dollars in perpetuity. those are my impressions of Frank. They aren't based on any real personal observations. I saw him only, I think, a couple times in the university club. I happened to be there when he was there, and at these functions where I was the waiter.
You talked about Dean Sellery, Dean of LNS,
mm-hmm.
Very, as I can perceive, a very powerful figure
very
on campus. Could you talk a little bit about him and his position on campus and his relationship with faculty?
Yeah. As you say, he was very powerful. He was Dean of the Letters and Science, and therefore in the department where I got my first appointment. He was the one who appointed me, and he brought me in and for an interview, and I remember he was quite incisive and also inquisitive about certain things. I had been supported by Walter Morton, who was my major professor.
Yes.
And Walter and Ingram, Sellery.
And Ingram,
yes. Walter and Sellery were I think, strong supporters of each other.
Oh, really?
Yes,
I thought you were going to say loggerheads.
No. On the contrary, my clear impression was that Walter Morton was supported by Sellery, and he certainly supported Sellery.
Interesting.
And he supported Sellery against whoever was the president at that time, Ben Frank earlier certainly, and perhaps Dykstra. When did Dykstra become president?
About 1930,
no,
30, end of
37,
I think it was.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think feel quite confident about that.
Mm-hmm.
He was, of course, a great teacher, Sellery. Small groups, I have many students who I work with, and just terrific. Mm-hmm. He didn't do a whole lot of teaching. He was a rather strict administrator. I don't know enough to feel confident as to whether he was, you know, very straight-backed and would not make adjustments. He was pretty firm. He ran the show, as you all know, I both know, I'm sure. He was very much opposed to the experimental college.
Mm-hmm.
He was very much opposed to the...
Was he opposed to the experimental college, or was he opposed to the way it was presented and the way it was more or less, LNS was used as an old-fashioned, stodgy way of education?
I wouldn't know.
That seems to be an important issue. I'm trying to figure out if he was unbendingly rigid or if he was just a very firm person. There seems to be a distinction
yes.
there that is crucial.
Well, I really couldn't help you on that. I think he resented the implication that letters and science in the old ways were... I remember Sellery saying to a group of students, he often met with students down in the union, and he and I guess perhaps also in discussions, few discussions, I said, I'm a radical in everything but education.
Okay.
A radical in everything but education.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And he was a liberal, you know, he supported the Cardinal Strike.
Yes, but he paid for a whole issue.
That's right, and when he would get up there and gave this talk, you could feel steel coming through. I had great admiration for him.
Was that a general feeling in the faculty?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I would imagine that there are a lot of people who found him too domineering. Mm-hmm. He was a much more domineering kind of person than Ingram. He ran a very tight ship. He had very high standards. I would say he was an excellent dean.
What about one other person that I'm interested in, and then we'll get off this people thing. What about President Dykstra? Did you have enough opportunity to observe him, and could you make some comments on him?
Some opportunity, not a great deal, but I knew him. I had some meetings with him, a couple of social meetings and some others. I never felt very closely acquainted with him. I know that there was it grew up pretty rapidly, if there was not initially considerable opposition to Dykstra among the faculty. It was rather hard to pin him down many times, and they felt he did not give real leadership.
I always get this feeling, excuse me, that there's this this can't-win situation when you become president of the University of Wisconsin, because traditionally the faculty has been very strong, very active force on this campus, and yet when you get a president who doesn't lead, you get the feeling that you don't have a leader, and when you get a president who leads, he's a bully, and he leads you around by the nose, and who does he think he is?
Yeah, well, that may be. It may be, and I think that's probably not peculiar to the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, I would think so. But I would think it would be maybe even a little more so because the faculty, at least as I am understanding it, has perhaps been a stronger element on this campus than on most from a historic perspective.
I think that's true. The only possible exception I know of among the major universities is the University of California, where again the faculty is extremely strong, very active, strong. And their chancellors and of the campuses and their president has plenty of. They have to be very careful about their faculty. I did not have terribly great admiration for Dykstra's work as the president. I don't think he was a really very, very good president. I suspect we had better leadership from the president's office when Sellery was in there.
I don't know if you know anything about this, but just from what I've been looking, I was kind of surprised when Sellery was named interim manager, and then they brought in the former city manager from Cincinnati. How did the faculty feel about that, or were you around?
Well, I'm not sure. I was. When did he come in?
1937, I think.
Yeah.
That was the end of 37.
Dykstra.
Yeah.
There was some feeling that that was not the kind of person that should be made president. There was rather a strong feeling that somebody from the university itself should be named. And Dykstra was supported by La Follette. La Follette was the person who pushed Dykstra. Mm-hmm. Dykstra was at least loosely affiliated with the Progressive Party. She certainly identified with it. And of course, Wilkie as well as Napolitt, Bob and Phil were Progressive Party people, and they felt that Dykstra would be a good person. And I think the time I met Dykstra socially was at the home of one of the members of the law faculty, forgotten. And Beinsinger was there, I remember, but also Phil Pollitt.
Garrison?
Yes, Garrison.
I mean, it wasn't his house.
He was the dean then, I think. And he had us, my wife, over to, and this is the time I met Phil Pollitt, who was very appealing. As I remember, Dykstra was there. But no question about it that group was, liberal, progressive kind of people. And of course, Phil Pollitt was especially a political ambitious person, politically ambitious.
So the same group that more or less was responsible for getting President Frank out of office, that progressive faction of the regions, could conceivably have been influential in getting Dykstra into the university. I assume then that Sellery was not in that progressive tradition.
I presume that's correct. I would think that's right. He was, John Goss was one of those people who was associated with the Follets and then the progressive tradition. And Dyke, Sellery was not a great admirer of John Goss, nor vice versa. John Goss, of course, was interested in the experimental college. He was associated with Michael John, as I remember. I don't know that he ever taught there, but perhaps he did.
I think so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The political science also was in rivalry with the Department of History. Sellery was with the Department of History. He was not too much in favor of those who were in the political science department. I think it's true. Whether justifiably or not.
Okay, I have.
Do you remember that the time when the hearings about Frank were going on? Do you remember how much you were aware of it, how interested you were in it, what you thought of it?
Very interested. But I didn't attend them. I just read the press.
Mm-hmm.
And as I remember, I read this. The Capital Times, who were against Frank, and of course were progressive in the politics, and associated with Wilkie and others who were against Fred. Frank.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't remember how long a hiatus was there between the time Frank left.
And Dykstra came.
Dykstra came.
I think it was about 6 months or so.
I
don't know. I'd have to check on that. I just can't recall right now.
It's certainly, after 33 that Frank was thrown out because I was here.
Well, he was thrown out in December of 1936, I'm sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm positive of
that. So there were several years there.
Yeah.
When the perception I got from reading newspaper accounts, et cetera, was that the students were very much opposed to Frank leaving office. I don't know if they were opposed to the way he was disposed of or the fact that they were that he was popular among students. Do you have any idea how student?
I really don't have any accurate. My supposition would be that they didn't like the way it was done, more than that they supported Frank.
Mm-hmm. How did the faculty feel about the way it was done? Or how did you feel about the way it was done?
I was glad it was done. I thought they needed a new president. And I thought he was staying on justifiable grounds, that he was using the university at that time for political purposes. And that therefore, when political forces were arrayed against him, it was not inappropriate.
You live by the sword and you die by the sword. Yeah, that's an interesting point. That's yeah, right. Quite.
I think there are a lot of people who felt that way. But as you know, the faculty is not a monolithic group. I was still a young faculty member then, of course. In fact, when he was kicked out, I was still a graduate student. I wasn't even, I became instructor in 37. But we followed it. I know there wasn't much sympathy for Frank in among the graduate students in economics. I don't have any feeling for the undergraduates, because mm-hmm. there just never was one.
I want to ask you a couple of quick questions about being a graduate student, getting back to that for a moment. You said you could speak for the other, you said there wasn't much sympathy among the graduate students in economics. Were you a very closely knit group?
No. No, not really. We got along. We saw each other socially. I had several good friends.
What I'm looking for is, that was a bad question. What kind of a sense of community existed amongst graduate students, not only departmentally, but on a campus-wide basis?
On a campus-wide basis, I wouldn't really have any idea. I did live in the graduate dormitory that year I was a fellow, and so there I met quite a cross-section of graduate students from the different disciplines, in geology and chemistry and so on across. We were, of course, the fellows, and we were perhaps not representative of a lot of the students, but we got along well socially. We had a feeling of some common interest on economic grounds, but for that group, those were not acute problems. Even for me, I remember I got along on $600 a year, plus a little extra I got from my mother and father at that time. And then I had a nice fellowship coming up, and the instructorship promised me when I came back. So I was well taken care of by those standards of those days and didn't feel at all rested. But there were no, I don't remember any graduate student common action or common position. We never have meetings except as they got into the union, which was a little later. I was in the graduate dormitory in 34, 35. And then I lived with a fellow in an apartment the next year and then went to England. I suspect that there was no great esprit de corps among the graduate students across the campus. People were interested in their own disciplines. I suspect that's generally true of graduate students everywhere.
Did you get together the economic graduate students? Did you talk very much? Intellectually, I mean, was there a lot of exchange?
Talk about economic matters.
Was that an important part of your life? Your gathering with them in the evening?
Yeah. Where did you gather? Did you gather in the union, in homes, or just anywhere?
Homes and so forth.
Apartments.
And departments. The assistants in economics had kind of a bullpen. We had desks around, and we'd sit there and gas. There were, of course, a lot of interesting economic issues in those days.
Yeah, it was an interesting time to be a graduate student in economics.
It was, but there was a high degree of consensus among the graduate students in economics that the things that were being done in a New Deal were needed to be done.
Well, so you would classify them as maybe a New Deal, more liberal type. Was that a tradition? Would that be, could you speak wider for the campus? Did that seem to be the...
Couldn't say.
Okay, but in economics it would certainly be.
Yeah, among the others I knew, I never... Well, it was hard to find somebody who would say that they should go back to times of Hoover and Coolidge.
Yeah, right. I suppose it was pretty popular to be a
Hoover. You wouldn't find many of them, I think.
When did you become aware of Keynesian economics?
When I first read the treatise on money in 1930-31. It's one of the first books
did
I bought.
Did you write it that early?
The treatise was 30.
Oh.
30. The general theory, which is the most celebrated, of course, was 36.
Yeah.
But I cottoned to Keynes immediately from 1930. And he was writing also, as he did later, tracts for the Times. He was one of those people enormously influential in terms of at least the social scientists, because he was terribly persuasive, and he had ideas, these ideas that Hoover and some of the
we'll confine ourselves to the, or not necessarily confine ourselves, but the economics department. This morning, then, okay. Which is October 11th, 1982, I don't know how much you were aware of the department's politics and concerns when you were a graduate student. Were you?
Oh, a little. I could sense some of the personality conflicts. And this man I'll call Mr. M.
You don't have to. It's well known whom you're talking about.
Very good. Walter Martin.
Yes.
Was my major professor. And he was at odds with several of the older people in the department, including Keith Gopher and to some extent Witte. I must confess, I was his protege. And so he intervened with the chairman, who was then Harry Jerome. And Walter, as was his wont, would have certain difficulty with anybody in authority. And so he had some difficulty with Jerome, too. And when I told him that my application for the fellowship for the second year, first year of a fellowship, had not been granted. He blew up, I remember, and stormed out of his office down to see Jerome. And all kinds of those so-and-sos and so-and-sos. And eventually I got the fellowship. Now, just what was behind that, I don't know. But as a consequence, being close to Walter Martin, I was pretty close to many of the conflicts, personal and otherwise, in the department, even before I went as an instructor on the faculty in 1937. I think I mentioned the other day that Walter put me up for this instructorship, which was coming up in 1937, mm-hmm. And he went to Celery with that proposal, and Celery interviewed me. And Celery, I think against the preferences of some of the faculty at any rate, appointed me.
Hmm. Just always like to make sure. I'm interested in your statement that you were Walter Morton's protege. Were you when you came, or was it after you arrived that...
After I arrived, but I would say during the first year. I went into some of Walter Morton's classes, and I enjoyed them very much, and I became rather close to him intellectually. And he took a fancy to me and to the things I was interested in. And therefore, he tried to help me. He also was particularly against Kiekhofer at the time, and I believe Kiekhofer had an alternative candidate for that
instructorship.
Mm-hmm. And so Morton pushed me against Kiekhofer, and there may have been others involved too. But I had good relations with the rest of the faculty as far as my own relations mm-hmm. are concerned at that time.
What was Morton like as a teacher?
Well, he's extremely stimulating, particularly at a time as in 33, 34, when the economic world was in a turmoil, and the New Deal was starting, and new proposals were being made, and there was a real cleavage between old-line economics and new ideas. He was in the vanguard, and very bright, articulate, although not well organized, and therefore sitting in his classes was really fun and stimulating. Whereas, of course, in some other fields and with some of the people, we were going over old stuff that didn't seem to be very relevant to what was going on in the world.
So he was really paying attention to events that were going on right then and making you think about them.
That's right. You know, he was excellent in that respect. Of course, gradually, I think he became more critical of almost everybody and everything. And so he'd find anybody who got attention and or anything like authority, intellectually or politically, he would have things to say against him. But that was not so much true at that time.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say, you mean anybody... Even on the national level, nationally known, you're
surely
not talking about the department, but...
Both.
Just both, yes.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So he didn't ever turn against his students then?
He turned against some students who may have been... protege, perhaps, of other professors.
Hmm.
And he turned against, shall we say, people who resisted new ideas. He was very critical of a lot of students. In his seminars, didn't no matter who you were, you had a hard time making a connected presentation of anything because he was always interrupting.
Hmm.
Not necessarily to try to confute you or do anything that make it embarrassing, but just because she was rising up and saying something all the time. And so I remember, as I say, I got along with him well, but I remember very well saying, "Now, Walter, I'm talking, and you just let me talk for a while." He rather liked that kind of independence.
This was when you were still a graduate
That's
student.
That's right. Mm-hmm. He rather liked that independence. He disliked people who were, as he thought, sort of tradition-bound or bowed by authority. He's a real heretic and a and iconoclast, and a rebel.
You're not using any medical terms for him. You wouldn't, would you say that
he... I would hesitate to do so. I think he was a psychological case. I've heard other people say it, but I have no reason to diagnose his malady. Mm-hmm. But there was a malady, no doubt about it. It was worse in the middle years than it was later on.
Oh, the middle years, what, the 40s or
the
30s?
I presume in the 30s, although I didn't feel as acutely because I was on his side and I didn't have any authority, I didn't have any responsibility really. But I suppose it was that way even then. And then in the 40s and 50s, he was extremely difficult, acting like a paranoid.
I've certainly gotten that impression from many people.
Yes, and then that gradually, as he got sort of, what we did really was build a pretty solid coalition against him, and excluded him from any decision making. Basically, made it so uncomfortable for him that he. He didn't participate, but just went outside and criticized and went his own way, particularly as a consultant.
Well, one of the things that happened was the hiring of Milton Friedman.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
I was in Washington at the time.
Oh.
But I heard reports and from students. You see, I was pretty young. I still a graduate student. So I knew the students pretty well by that time, and also from Walter Morton,
who I think it was Les Cohere, I guess, who got Friedman, was it?
Maybe Les Cohere was. It was either Les Cohere Groves, who was chairman at that time, and I rather think it was Groves, but I wouldn't.
Oh,
be sure.
Yes. Yes, that's it. Harold Groves invited Milton Friedman here to be an assistant professor,
I guess.
That's
right.
Yeah.
And so I was in touch. I was by that time an assistant professor.
Mm-hmm.
I became that in 1939. I went to Washington, as I said, in 1940-41, again from the middle of 42 on through the war. And I believe this incident occurred in 42. At any rate, it was when I was away.
Of course, Milton Friedman didn't have the reputation that he has now. I don't suppose anybody thought twice about it.
That's right. He was, however, well identified and identifiable as a very conservative economist of the time, a free market man, an anti-Keynesian, he was, and I'd say probably antipathetic to Wisconsin institutionalism. And for that reason, there were things that people might bring against him on either intellectual or ideological ground, even at the time.
What do you mean by Wisconsin institutionalism?
Well, that which came from John R. Commons and carried on by Ed Witte and Zadig Perlman, Martin Glaser, Harold Groves, Elizabeth Brandeis, Ken Parsons in agricultural economics, it was at its height, I would say, with Commons, who had national, international reputation as an institutionalist theorist.
Mm-hmm.
The other people were more specialized. a Witte in labor economics, Perlman in labor economics, a Glazier in public utilities, Harold Groves in public finance. But the intellectual leader of that was undoubtedly Commons. Ely had been associated with Commons earlier in that same mm-hmm. kind of institutionalism. By the time, I was always considered a sort of in-between person with one foot in either on either side of institutionalism versus theoretical economics. It was a very natural position to be in. And that, of course, is part of the basis of controversy. Although Walter Martin was in some ways an anti-theorist, on the other hand, he was very critical of institutionalism, too. He's critical of everything. So that's what I mean by institutionalism. And Milton Friedman had no interest in institutions except to say that it should all be a market mechanism mm. and government should not have influence. Large groups, organized groups should not have influence. Mm-hmm. Whereas institutionalism was the economics of organized groups, governmental and non-governmental. Mm.
Do you know? Apparently Friedman might have stayed, but at least I have a... I guess Harold Groves feels that he had been appointed without the support of the department and that his appointment was later retracted.
His promotion was retracted.
Promotion.
To associate professor.
Under political pressure and intrigue by Morton and Fay Elwell is the way he put it.
Is that the way Harold Groves, mm. long ago, eh? Yes, that is correct, mm. basically. They, Morton and Elwell, were the spearheads of the opposition to Friedman and scuttled the associate professorship.
How does Elwell fit in? I know that he's very closely involved with the economics department and they're in each other's pockets.
Well. Because he was the head.
They were
of
part of the department. They were all in the department,
well,
weren't
that
they?
Was,
for a while.
That was quite a long time ago. I don't know when it was separated, but it was separated from economics certainly before I got there. And it was a school of commerce, however, within the College of Letters and Science, you see. So it was part of the same academic domain, even though it had become separate from the Department of Economics. We had some joint appointments.
Well, that's it. Elwell still had his joint appointment with economics until 1935 or 6.
Did he really?
Yes.
So
I guess that's why I was thinking. But
he was not active. He uh-huh. was. He was in the commerce, and he was the dean. But he was antipathetic to economics. As a discipline, he was particularly antipathetic to what he considered the liberal or radical wings of the department.
Which must have been nearly everybody.
Well, most. Mm-hmm. There would certainly be Witte and Perlman especially. Glazier, however, had a joint appointment and was with commerce and therefore was sort of in the middle. There were others. Trumbauer had a joint appointment. There were others he didn't have his guns out for, but he didn't like economics. He thought it was just not practical enough, you know. He was a very narrow man, intellectually, and in other respects, I would say, since this is sealed. he was aggressive. He was anti-Semite. No doubt about that. This is one of the things, really, that they used in opposing Friedman. But he also felt that way about Perlman, who was a Jewish, of course. He was a really mean man, in my view, Elwell. I've never found anything to say that was really terribly complimentary about him. But he sided with Morton at that time.
Yeah, you don't speak of him and Morton at all in the same way.
Well, no, not in terms of their intellectual capacities, their worthwhileness. Morton, despite all his handicaps, shall we say, was really a very bright and interesting, stimulating person.
Was Morton anti-Semitic?
I never could tell. There, again, because it's sealed, I had heard that he was Jewish, or at least part Jewish, and that perhaps that was the reason for his anti-Semitism. He was, as some of those people get caught and have difficulty being objective about those things. So I remember he was always very anti-Zionist, but he was anti almost everything. He, of course, was an ally, or shall we say, Perlman was an ally of Morton most of the year until quite late. You never could tell who was using whom, but they were at a symbiosis. One characteristic, by the way, of the economics department in those days and until quite a while later was that virtually all of the people had got their degrees at Wisconsin.
Oh, that's the origin of the criticism of the department.
That's right. It was a very valid criticism, it was. But since I got my degree here and was appointed, it was not something that I railed against until later. Hence they were close-knit in a sense, and they were more concerned often about their personal relationships and their personal status and all that than they were about the intellectual problems in which they were trying to work. But Walter Morton especially exacerbated that situation. And so the lineup shifted somewhat depending upon what the issues were. But it was, it had become by that time in terms of leadership, effective leadership, a pretty weak department. And I would say in terms of personnel, a pretty weak department. It had been a great department, or considered so, when Commons had been there and Ely.
So you mean intellectually it was
That's
a weak department?
Professionally. And it really badly needed resuscitation.
Various people must have perceived this.
Yes, I think Harold Groves perceived it. I'm not sure that Ed Whitty did. They began to bring in people other than Wisconsin PhDs only, I believe, with Paul Ellsworth, who came in 44 or 45. Mm-hmm. He had a Harvard degree, and he was quite, had relationships with institutionalism, quite a different kind of person. And then we began to get people from other places because it became a matter of policy.
But this was generally frowned on in the university. Was it debated in faculty meetings? I mean, were you all aware of it?
Sometimes we were, and more of us became more convinced that this was a bad way of running a department, gradually. But Indeed, I don't remember, but after, well, for two or three years after the war, there were one or two people whom Kiekhofer favored, and he was in charge of the elementary course, and he was also getting quite old. He was a senior person. So in a sense, for the successor of Kiekhofer, the door was beginning to open up, and Kiekhofer had a couple of protégés whom he wanted to hire, mm-hmm. and they were young, they were my generation, but they were turned down by the department. I was then in, I became an associate professor, I think, in 1942. That was perhaps an indirect result of the Friedman affair. In other words, some people said, look, here's Jim Early, he's been here for so many years, and you know, fine man, and so forth, and you're bringing in this youngster from Chicago, mm-hmm. putting him over Jim Early's head, you see. Mm-hmm. I didn't myself oppose Friedman's, but I said I expected to be recognized, and I think what happened really was that I was recognized probably before my time, mm-hmm. and Friedman was still no.
Did you respect Friedman as a scholar?
I've always had serious reservations about his scholarship.
Even then?
Yes, although, you know, he, as I say, he wasn't as prominent then. He hadn't done so much then. He was a new PhD. Mm-hmm. And so that only built up gradually. I have a feeling, frankly, that his economics is dictated by his ideology and his research program and everything else that he has done is dictated by his ideology, and I dislike that.
So he's managed to get such a name simply because of being able to pose as a scholar on a side that most economists don't support.
It's not posing, because he's a very persuasive, very effective person, both in written word and in oral presentation. Mm-hmm. Extremely persuasive, and therefore many of his things were quite impressive, but I felt that they were usually based on unsound premises. And they used a methodology which was foreordained to come out with the conclusions that he wanted, rather than something more experimental and eclectic. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, he's no doubt a high-powered intellectual.
Elizabeth Brandeis was teaching all along through here. What imprint did she make on the department, if any?
Well, I really don't know. My impression is that it was not great. She was an institutionalist in labor economics and labor history, where they'd had illustrious people such as Commons and Perlman. She followed along sort of, she was junior of Perlman. She was more or less a contemporary of Groves and Morton. Mm-hmm. In fact, there were difficulties arising because of that kind of relationship.
Yes, Morton didn't have much use for her.
Oh, no. I never had any work with her. I liked her. She was an extremely decent human being. She was certainly bright enough. She was not interested in the kinds of things that I was interested in, however. Mm-hmm. And my impression is that, and she was only part-time.
Yes.
My impression is that she didn't have much impact on the department. She had, I think, only a half, I'm not sure whether they may reduced her to a half vote or not, but that was the
I'm not even sure she had any. Do you think she had? She was an instructor.
She was a lecturer later, I guess, right? I'm not sure she never had an ordinary tenure position.
Mm-hmm. No, not until Ed Young came along, I guess.
So she, I think, had relatively little influence. Groves had influence. Duskeher had very little influence.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, there are a whole group of labor economists, Witte, Broman, Duskeher, Elizabeth, perhaps there was somebody else, and I've forgotten. But it's a large group, and she was somewhat submerged in it.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the, you were probably away when Harold Groves, the incident about the Committee on Economic Development.
No, I just got back. As I remember, he took that position in 1945, perhaps. And I came back in the fall of 45. It was one of those things about which Walter Martin was criticizing him very severely.
Yes.
As if he had betrayed his liberal heritage and that. And so I was pretty well acquainted with that.
What was your own reaction to
it? I thought it was a perfectly okay thing for Harold to do. And by that time I had become rather suspicious of Walter Martin's attitudes and positions and so forth, and I thought that was one of them. The Committee on Economic Development was sort of a businessman's group of intellectuals, so to speak, and if, as we would consider them now, on the liberal side of the business community.
Hmm.
And they were doing new things, and Harold, I think, never wavered because of that affiliation and what he thought was right. Harold, however, was a sort of middle-of-the-road person, Walter made a great fuss about it, and I don't think justifiably.
Did you know that Harold Groves had written something called In and Out of the Ivory Tower?
No.
It's a 200-page autobiography.
Oh,
it's in the archives over there.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, as you can imagine,
yes.
Anybody who writes an autobiography. One of the things he says in it, I wrote down this quote, is, "Many of my erstwhile liberal friends in Wisconsin hardly spoke to me anymore. What was infinitely worse, I began to entertain serious doubts about my own integrity."
That is rather characteristic of Harold. Very sensitive, very concerned about all kinds of ethical problems. And his confidence was only moderate.
Mm.
His self-confidence was only moderate. And that I can understand. Yeah.
Well, do you, Ed Young came in 48 or 49 just as a graduate student.
He came a little earlier than that. I believe he came as a graduate student in 46.
Mm.
I'm not sure, but I believe so. I had him in course. You see, I was teaching as an instructor and then an assistant professor.
Mm-hmm.
And after the war, I was a very young associate professor. I taught a beginning theory course, so-called, and then I began to teach the history of economic thought, for which I had been really chosen, and so I worked at that.